information on some murder. I never have either. I think it has something to do with the illustrious gathering that we've attracted today. Feedback is going to be a theme. Public hearing on House Bill 2282. Attorney General Frohnmayer is here, and we'd like to take your testimony first, Dave.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. For the record, I'm Dave Frohnmayer, representing the Department of Justice. I'm accompanied by Assistant Attorney General Pete Shepard, whom I think is well known to members of this committee as probably one of the most foremost, if not the foremost, expert on the law of forfeiture currently in the state of Oregon. He's been of assistance to the interim committee in helping to develop the forfeiture measures, and I appreciate that committee staff, as well as members of the committee, have spent inordinate numbers of hours attempting to develop a law that is meaningful, that will work, and that now we know is needed, at least if a Court of Appeals decision stands, to replace what has become the single most effective tool that law enforcement has in this state to deal with the problem of drug profiteering. There are many changes and there are many reforms that are pending before this legislative assembly which will be of assistance in the law enforcement side in fighting drugs. But my own personal experience from talking to dozens of county officials, to law enforcement officials, to prosecutors, shows the absolutely essential nature of the forfeiture remedy and of a workable forfeiture remedy as a vital tool in the arsenal of law enforcement. The importance of this tool has been further accentuated by an unfortunate set of amendments enacted in the Congress, of which many people are aware, dealing with certain technical requirements that forfeitures must meet in order for full advantage to be taken of the federal forfeiture law. Now, by way of introduction, I should also say that the state does have at its disposal and local law enforcement has certain techniques that can be used to achieve what forfeitures do. The RICO law, which has been in existence since 1981, has proved to be, under certain circumstances, a highly effective measure to deal with problems of drug traffickers, but it does have a requirement of predicate offenses that makes it a less targeted vehicle than a direct forfeiture law itself. All of this is a way of saying we think this is the most important priority bill that you have to deal with this session if you want to give law enforcement realistic, usable, powerful tools to take the profit out of organized crime, the profit in organized crime, of course, in drug trafficking. We also believe, Madam Chair, and I know you've voiced these concerns in other respects, we believe this law can be administered with fairness and with appropriate regard for civil liberties. Oregon is not the first state to have experimented with forfeiture laws. They date clear back to the last century. We have been excruciatingly careful in the initiation of RICO proceedings because we know that this legislative assembly exists as an ultimate sanction if law enforcement misuses a powerful tool at its disposal. And we are very conscious that the administration of any such law needs to be done in such a way that would withstand legislative scrutiny. And you now have nearly 8 years of administration of the RICO laws. I'd be very surprised if any of your members or any of you collectively have received complaints that those laws have been administered in a way which is violative of the liberties of our citizens or is abusive of law enforcement's authority. We have, I know, discussed with the chair various possibilities, assuring a more formal role for legislative oversight. We certainly have no objection to that measure, and we'd be pleased to work with the committee or to look at whatever suggestions the committee has in terms of having more detailed week by week, year by year scrutiny of how forfeiture laws are administered. Finally, Madam Chair, we have had an opportunity to review amendments which I understand are being proposed by the governor's office, and it will come as no surprise to that office that we have certain problems with those amendments, at least in their present form. I don't know whether the better way is to respond to questions from the committee to deal with those issues or to talk to you directly about them. But let me mention a couple of the major issues that we confront. One of the issues is a very important one, and we saw this very early in the development of the RICO law. And it's important for law enforcement generally and for the fight against narcotics generally, and that is to encourage the maximum amount of interagency cooperation. when the Department of Justice is involved in anti-drug activities, as we occasionally are, asked to participate in federal task forces or federal, state, local task forces, we do that on a cooperative basis. If there exists a situation where not all of the agencies that participate, in fact, are given remuneration for their out-of-pocket financial costs, that discourages interagency cooperation, and what it creates is a very unseemly race to the courthouse steps, or at least tendencies to do that. So I would hope that the formulas that for sharing are, in fact, equitable ones, and in fact, give due regard to every agency that takes part. Now, the reason that I mention that is that, at least as we read the amendments from the governor's office, and this may not be their proper reading or their intention, if we engage in an operation and our office shares responsibility for that operation with the local sheriff's office, my understanding is that there is no provision in these amendments to allow us to share our investigative costs with the agency that assisted us. That's very counterproductive to and a step backwards from the law enforcement cooperation that we want to encourage. And a second concern we have with these amendments is that although they limit our department to, if the Department of Justice is involved, they limit us to costs, they don't include our investigation costs. And that, of course, is a significant issue in a forfeiture of any magnitude or an investigation of any difficulty. So we believe that those formulas do not adequately provide for the kinds of expenses that would be incurred. There are a number of options by way of which the committee could proceed, but Madam Chair, I think I'll ask for Assistant Attorney General Shepherd to add any comments of his own, and then we'd be pleased to respond to your questions.
Madam Chair, really I haven't anything to add to the Attorney General's comments. I have some specific comments about amendments, technical and otherwise, that we have proposed previously to the committee, and a brief comment or two about some of the other proposed amendments, but I don't know whether the committee is prepared to address those now.
Great. Actually, I would appreciate you addressing those now, unless there are questions right now for Mr. Frohnmayer. And if you don't mind, Dave, staying here, I don't know what your time frame is like. We're always delighted to see you.
Thank you. I'm at the disposal of the committee at least for the next hour or so, and Mr. Shepherd obviously knows the policy direction of our office. The only disquiet I feel, Madam Chair, is I'm responding to we're responding to amendments before those who are offering them may have had a chance to testify about them. And so my, if you understand the diplomacy, I guess we all do, those may, we'll give the objections first, even though that's the order.
I appreciate that, not so much as a diplomacy, but I think as a strategy, it's a difficult position for you to be in. And if you would, you know, like to stay and then comment, because if there are going to be pot shots taken at your position, I imagine that you're up here exposing that position. But I appreciate you taking
There's a certain amount of shadow boxing involved in my testimony, as you can well imagine, but why don't we proceed?
Why don't you go ahead then, Pete?
Madam Chair, we submitted at the last session of this committee in its considerations of this bill technical amendments and then two substantive amendments to the proposal. I think the technical amendments are self-explanatory. They're contained in a single page and a little more than a page, I guess. Correction of typographical errors and that sort of thing in the bill. There's nothing in those, and they've been identified as technical amendments, and there's nothing in those that I think reflect any policy considerations. The first amendment that does reflect some policy consideration is amendment number one, and this is the amendment which would permit the local agency which made a seizure of less than $1,000 in cash to proceed with an administrative forfeiture without first publishing notice of their intent to so proceed. They would be required still to furnish notice to every person that they knew had an interest in that $1,000. But the proposed amendment would eliminate the requirement that they publish notice. And the reason for that proposal is this. After the proposal was drafted and produced in bill form, I was informed that there are more cases than we had previously thought of seizures of less than $1,000. Here in Salem, for example, the Salem Police Department has a street crimes enforcement unit. funded in part through a federal grant and in part through their own resources. And the focus of that unit is on street-level drug dealers here in Salem. The nature of the seizures that that unit makes tend to be less than $1,000. And it was pointed out to me with some force that if the publication requirement were maintained for those seizures, it would very quickly eat up or even exceed the cost of those forfeitures.
Mr. Shepherd, are you aware of opposition to this?
No, I'm not. There was a question raised at the last session of this committee as to whether that comported with due process.
I recall that. Let's go ahead. I think we're clear on what the intent of Amendment Number 1 is.
Amendment Number 2, then, is the second substantive amendment. And this is an amendment which provides that a governmental agency which transfers title to property in conformance with a judgment of forfeiture shall be immune from liability as a consequence of that transference. Now, the problem that this amendment is intended to address is the concern that our Department of Motor Vehicles has had under present forfeiture schemes and would continue apparently to have in the absence of some amendment under House Bill 2282 with respect to their potential liability for transferring title in response to a judgment of forfeiture. Their concern is that if some party had not been notified as required and yet a judgment was issued on the basis of the forfeiture action, that the party which was not notified might later have some recourse against the Department of Motor Vehicles for having transferred title to that vehicle without securing that party's permission.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
question.
President Clark.
How is this different than a county tax foreclosure? I mean, the county's got the same concerns, I assume, when a county comes in and forecloses a piece of property for failure to pay taxes. How's it different? I mean, it's more urgent, certainly, the overall issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I'm not familiar with the process of county foreclosure actions, although those, of course, would not involve the Department of Motor Vehicles in any way. I don't know how it would differ from those standpoints. I can only relay to the committee the Department of Motor Vehicles' concern about that provision of the bill. And this amendment is intended to clear away that barrier to transference of title. This has been a significant problem for law enforcement agencies under existing forfeiture schemes. We're trying now to work with the Department of Motor Vehicles to resolve that question, but it has been a significant barrier. And those are the two amendments proposed by our office and the reasons for them.
Yes, Representative Mason.
To the title, the immunity of civil criminal prosecution, et cetera, title you just discussed, who's opposed to that, or what's the...
Representative Bauman, Representative Mason, I know of no opposition to that proposal.
Any other questions for Attorney General Palmer or for Mr. Shepherd?
On the amendments.
Representative Edmondson, on the amendments, or I suppose if you have a question now,
thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shepherd, I appreciate you providing us the facts on forfeiture because my notes show that you had promised to answer about taking clause, and I see that you've done that. I guess your opinion is that the Oregon courts haven't ruled on the constitutionality of the taking clause for forfeitures, but you see them following the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling, which was that forfeiture is not a taking under the Constitution.
Madam Chair, Representative Edmondson, that's correct. As best as I can discern from the existing opinions on the takings clause in Oregon, the cases to which we are to look for guidance are the federal cases, and they have upheld the federal forfeiture scheme on that basis.
I wanted to ask Attorney General Frohnmayer a question I thought I asked you. I think it's an important one. Dealing with the constitutional prohibition of forfeiture of estate upon conviction. Attorney General Frohnmayer, do you see that we are, at least through this law, accomplishing in an in rem proceeding what we could not accomplish in a personal proceeding? And therefore, the Constitution and the questions, the last, I'm sort of backgrounding you on this, the Constitution fairly strictly prohibits, I mean, it absolutely prohibits upon conviction the forfeiture of estate. And yet, it seems like in this law, what we are saying is that forfeiture of estate is okay when there is no conviction. And that seems to be getting at a remedy that's even stricter than the one the Constitution prohibits, and that bothers me.
Yeah. Representative Edmonds, it's been many years. I think the last time I really looked at the forfeiture of estate and corruption of the blood provisions was when I was helping to revise the Oregon Probate Code way back in the late 1960s. But my memory is that the forfeiture of estate language is really quite technical. It refers to a total loss of a person. It really descends from English jurisprudence, where forfeiture of estate is literally you lost your lands, and you lost all of your interests in real property, irrespective of whether they were connected with what you did or not. The best reason I can think to give you off the top of my head as to why this is not a problem is that forfeitures are constitutionally authorized in Oregon right now in our Constitution. And that's really why we're here in some respects, because our Constitution says forfeitures go to the common school fund. So the people who wrote our Constitution in Oregon City in 1857 understood and impliedly authorized forfeiture as a lawful remedy and provided for the proceeds of those forfeitures to go to help schools. So my argument's really textual. It's really based on the existing text of the Oregon Constitution, which must be distinguishing between forfeiture of estate and a forfeiture, otherwise it wouldn't use both terms in the same Constitution because they'd cancel each other out.
Well, the term it uses, correct if I'm wrong, the term it uses in common is forfeiture, not estate. And so forfeitures of other than the estate, at least to read those two provisions consistently, forfeitures of other than estate would go in the common school fund. But I suppose it's like forfeitures not arising from conviction would go into the common school fund. I guess, and part of the problem, and Mr. Shepherd has addressed this briefly in his paper, Section 8 of the bill is the very first response that you make. Innocent owners are protected. Section 8 of the bill provides protection to innocent interest holders. We brought that up in the last hearing about just how that would work, because I had read that to be subsequent owners, basically, people who take in good faith. I'm trying to remember my UCC, folks who take in good faith from thieves, the remedies that we have to return goods. And I had read Section 8 to be that if a claimant took the property before it was seized for forfeiture and valuable consideration in good faith without intent to defeat the interest and without knowing it or prohibited conduct, that individual had an affirmative defense to the forfeiture of property. But then in the hearing, I began to realize that that was intended to protect the wife or the husband whose wife used a jointly owned car to distribute cocaine. And I guess I'm also, so I'm concerned about joint tenancy and things of that nature in real estate. I just wondered if you could respond.
I think it's intended to protect any legitimate bona fide security interest, not simply the holder in due course, but the bank, the credit union. What we're after is the illicit ownership, not the shared ownership in which the party is innocent or is a financial institution or something of the kind.
Madam Chair, Representative Edmondson, the defense is the broader version as you have described it, and I think that it certainly was intended to cover the kinds of things I've described in my list of things, which would include an absentee landlord whose tenant manufactured in one marijuana in one unit of the apartment, for example, or the husband whose wife used the jointly held car to transport narcotics. Or another hypothetical that's come up from time to time is a motel owner whose renter or tenant uses a unit of the motel to manufacture methamphetamine or some other substance. Of course, the defense would not be available to a landlord who knew that his or her tenants were using the residence for that purpose, or to the husband who knew that his wife was delivering drugs in the car, or to the motel owner who knew that prostitutes were using his or her motel rooms for that purpose.
Well, two witnesses and Madam Chair, I think that's an extremely important point to be established here in these proceedings, and I do appreciate the Attorney General's response and that of Mr. Shepherd's. Thank you.
Thank you for the questions, Representative Edmondson. Other questions? Representative Clark.
Mr. Shepherd, last time we were here, we had a discussion, I don't remember if you recall, with Mr. Fidanke from the ACLU about what to do with evidence gathered inappropriately, as it were, either in violation of the statute or I suppose in violation of the Constitution. You've addressed that here, and I wonder if you could just kind of go through that issue again, revisit that issue for us. The way the bill, as currently drafted, treats that issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, the way the bill treats the issue is the way I think that the Constitution, the federal Constitution, certainly and probably the state Constitution as well, requires us to treat evidence that is gained in the course of criminal investigations. The United States Supreme Court has held that some of the protections of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments apply in forfeiture proceedings because of their quasi-criminal nature. And has held that evidence obtained in violation of the United States Constitution cannot be used in prosecuting a forfeiture action. However, we are also informed by the federal courts that in pressing a forfeiture action, we may use any evidence which is not tainted by such an unconstitutional seizure. And the intent of this bill is to provide that a law enforcement agency which discovers that it has made an unconstitutional seizure in the first instance may nevertheless maintain the forfeiture action if independent evidence can be developed which would support that forfeiture.
My question the first time around had to do with whether there were some alternative to an exclusionary approach, and you're telling me that there probably isn't an alternative to an exclusionary approach, some other sanction that we could use on local government to and still use the evidence. You're telling me that the U.S. Supreme Court is telling us that is kind of a quasi-criminal case, and therefore we're going to kind of use the quasi-exclusionary rule.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I think that the certainly it's within the power of the legislature to create an additional remedy for violations of one's constitutional rights. I would say that, as we heard in the last session of this committee, that there exist civil remedies for violations of constitutional rights, and certainly those are not affected in any way by the proposed bill. The bill itself does not contain any alternative mechanism for enforcing those rights.
You might be interested to know that Mr. Fedanke provided me with a fascinating short history of the exclusionary rule, which I didn't know. Wigmore or somebody like that proposed that there be a sanction entitled contempt of the Constitution. That would be a charge brought against the violating officer with all sorts of dreadful consequences to that, and for obvious reasons, the exclusionary rule was preferred.
There are times I'm grateful that that is not a crime which would apply to legislative bodies.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I might add along that line that it is the unhappy duty of the division in which I work to prosecute police officers from time to time. And I know that in the history of our office, we have had occasion to prosecute police officers who had exceeded their authority and so violated the statutes pertaining to the limitations on the public officials' use of their power. So there are in fact some criminal sanctions which could be brought to bear.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Corey Streisinger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to testify concerning our amendments, which I mentioned briefly during the committee's previous hearing. I have not reviewed a number of the other amendments, but our concern primarily is with the issues addressed in the amendments, which I believe you have in a packet. They are the second set following those submitted by the Department of Justice. These amendments, as I mentioned during the previous hearing, are intended to address a drafting gap in the bill. As you are aware, we have proposed a constitutional amendment dealing with forfeiture, which would broaden the scope of areas for which forfeiture proceeds could be used. House Bill 2282, as drafted, contains provisions that would deal with forfeiture proceeds accruing to the state under the present Constitution. The bill then also recognizes the existence of the constitutional amendment by repealing those provisions if the constitutional amendment is adopted, but the bill as drafted does not replace them with other provisions specifying how the proceeds should be dealt with if the constitutional amendment is adopted, and that's what our amendments propose to do. What we have proposed in these amendments is basically three things. First of all, reimbursement to any agencies participating in the forfeiture. And I hate to disagree with the Attorney General's reading, and therefore perhaps he's correct that we didn't word this as carefully as we could. Our intention is certainly to provide reimbursement to any agencies, any forfeiting agencies, which on the state level would include both the state police and the Attorney General's office. The language appears on the first page of the proposed amendments, stating that costs shall first be paid from the property, defined to include cost disbursements and attorney's fees, and those special expenses incurred by the seizing agency in investigating and prosecuting a specific case. I don't see any reason why hourly investigative fees would be excluded by that language, but if the Attorney General's office feels that they are, we would certainly be pleased to discuss whether the language needs to be changed. The second, the bill also permits forfeiting agencies, which again would include at the state level, the state police and the Attorney General's office, to keep items which could be directly used for law enforcement purposes. The most common instance is seizure of a vehicle, and very often the vehicle can then be used for undercover work or other law enforcement work. It seemed to us not very efficient to force the forfeiting agency to sell the vehicle, perhaps for less than it would cost to purchase a similar vehicle, and then buy back vehicles for its own use. The dollar amounts are not large, and we therefore provided in these amendments that those kinds of equipment and other things which could be directly used could be kept by the forfeiting agency or could be transferred to other forfeiting agencies, so that if, for example, the state police seized a vehicle which they could not use but which a sheriff's office could use, they would be permitted to transfer the vehicle. Then third, our amendments provide that the balance after reimbursement of costs and after retention of those types of vehicles and equipment for direct law enforcement purposes, the balance would pour into a special reserved fund in the general fund, which could be allocated by the legislature for specified purposes, including law enforcement, prosecution, drug treatment, and drug education. Now, we had had discussions both with the state police and the Attorney General's office, both of whom do forfeitures at the state level, about whether or not a forfeiting agency should be able to retain not just costs, but also the proceeds of the forfeiture. So that, for example, if a forfeiture involved $200,000 in cash and costs $20,000 to investigate, prosecute, and sell the proceeds, that the question is whether the forfeiting agency should be able to retain $20,000 or the $200,000. Our proposal is that the forfeiting agency would keep the $20,000. $180,000 would then pour into a fund which the legislature could allocate through the normal process, either Ways and Means or the emergency board while the legislature is not in session. This is not an area which I do not know whether the Attorney General has a position on this. The governor feels that it is not appropriate for a forfeiting agency to be able to directly pocket forfeiture proceeds without legislative oversight and scrutiny. It's inconsistent with the general work of this body in making allocations based on comparison of needs, and it also does raise some of the problems which I'm sure you've heard testimony about concerning bounty hunting and perhaps inappropriate direction of law enforcement resources toward cases which will produce large amounts of cash in the agency's own pockets. I'll be happy to answer questions about these amendments or anything else in which you have questions.
Madam Chair.
Let's represent Baum first and then Representative Minnis.
Local government, let's say the Grand City Police are the ones that bust this lab in town, and inside there's cash, and you know, we get a couple $100,000 worth of assets there. Under the proposed amendment, they spent $5,000 in investigating that crime. They get the $5,000 back, and $195 goes to this special fund.
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, we have not addressed forfeitures by local entities in these amendments. They are dealt with in Section 10 of the bill. Section 10 is fairly complex, and I think you will hear testimony later today about how proceeds at the local level should be divided between local general funds, prosecuting entities, law enforcement entities, and so on. We have not addressed those issues. We are simply addressing the situation in which the forfeiting agency is an agency of the state, which ordinarily would be the state police or the Attorney General's
office. You have no intent. That's purely state officers doing that.
That's correct, Madam Chair, Representative Baum. The structure of the bill deals with local jurisdictions in Section 10, I believe, and the state in Section 11. And we have proposed amendments to Section 11, to replace Section 11 in the event that the constitutional amendment is adopted by the voters.
Representative Minnis?
Yes, Corey, how would the amendment affect interagency task forces where there's a cooperative effort between local jurisdictions and the state police or...
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, currently, as I understand the structure of the bill, one agency would end up being the forfeiting agency. And that forfeiting, whether the forfeiting agency, if the forfeiting agency was an agency of local government, it would be dealt with under the provisions of Section 10, and you may need to bring Mr. Shepherd back to answer this. My understanding is that sharing agreements would be permissible if the forfeiting agency were a local government. If the forfeiting agency ultimately, under an interagency sharing agreement, were an agency of the state police or the Department of Justice.
Okay, could we, maybe Mr. Shepherd can address that. I don't think I'd want to taint that money if the state was involved in a cooperative effort by local municipal police.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, I think that this touches on one of the concerns that the Attorney General expressed regarding interagency cooperation, because what the proposal would do is make it not very rational